The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
I'd like this morning to touch on the topic of karma, the Buddhist idea of karma. And it's been said that an understanding of karma is very central to very centrally important for people engaged in Buddhist practice. It's one of the key articles that Buddhist practitioners are meant to have confidence in or faith in. And hearing that, it can be a little bit of a turnoff. Oh no, it's like this metaphysical belief system that I'm not supposed to believe in. But it's not meant to be that way, I believe. And a variety of teachers down through the ages, including most recently the Dalai Lama, has said things like that an understanding of karma is more important than understanding of emptiness. In the Mahayana tradition that Dalai Lama is part of, emptiness is sometimes considered to be one of the most fundamentally important and difficult concepts and realizations in practice. And he says more important than this is to understand karma. And then there's a famous Zen story of this Zen teacher who, you know, periodically gives his Dharma talks. And in the back of the room, in the monastery, back of the hall, there comes an old man came. And he'd quietly come and listen to the talk and then leave. It happened over and over and over again. And then one day after the talk was over, rather than leaving, the old man came over to the abbot and said, formerly, in a past life, I was the abbot of this monastery. And someone asked me if an enlightened person is free of karma. And I said yes. And as a consequence, it's the karma of my answer. I have been reborn for 500 years as a fox. And tomorrow, if you go behind this boulder, behind the mountain, such as a place, you'll find... he didn't say it, but first he said, so now I've come to ask you, is an enlightened person free of karma? And the abbot said, an enlightened person does not ignore karma. And with that, the old man bowed and thanked, and he said, good. Now, if you go behind this boulder and this side of the mountain there, tomorrow morning you'll find the body of a fox. And can you please give it a monk's burial? And so, in fact, the next morning they found the fox there, and they buried it like a monk. And the abbot somehow had settled. You know, after 500 years as a fox, he came back as an old man and got the answer he needed to have. So karma is not to be ignored. He didn't say, you know, are you free of it? He said, no, it shouldn't be ignored. You need to pay attention to it. It's important to notice. So, as a further introduction to the topic of karma, I wanted to highlight a difference between the beginning of Jewish and Christian scripture, which I think conventionally begins with the book of Genesis. It begins with the doings of God. God is like the, you know, starts it all going. And there's no set beginning for Buddhist scriptures, but kind of as a convention, probably the most, one of the strongest candidates for the beginning of the Buddhist scriptures is the opening two verses of Dhammapada. And there, these verses say, all experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a corrupted mind, and suffering follows like the wagon wheel follows the hoofs of the ox. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind, speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows like a never departing shadow. And so here, if this is the beginning of the Buddhist scriptures, The emphasis here is the mind. So that's a huge difference, beginning with God or beginning with the mind. Where do you start? And I make this comparison mostly to make the point that in Buddhism, the mind has this very centrally important importance. It's really important what you do with your inner mental world. That gives birth to your impulses, to your perceptions, to your desires, to your intentions, your motivation, to your reactions. That inner world is really central to the whole enterprise of Buddhism. And because your suffering or your happiness is dependent on how that your mind functions, what you do with your mind, what you do with this inner world. So there has to be the sensitivity to that inner world, connection to it. And so the teaching on karma is pointing back to something that's right here. And if I may, kind of make almost like it's just, there's a kind of a cliche that's sometimes taught that in Buddhism, you are not punished for your sins. You're punished by your sins. And so when you're punished for your sins, then, you know, there's some idea of, you know, I don't know, there could be the arbitrator up in the sky who's going to say, well, you know, you go over there. But by your sins means the Buddhist idea of karma, of cause and effect, in the Buddhist point of view, is a natural law. It's just how things unfold, the cause and effect. So it's not any more difficult to understand than if I cling to the striker, and I cling to it really hard, like I'm desperately important. All my hope and aspiration and status is tied to having this striker. So I hold it really tight. And that clinging, if I pay attention, it hurts me hold it. It hurts physically. And what we say, what you notice if you look inside, that the impulse to cling, it doesn't start in the fist, it starts in the mind. And the movement to cling hurts. And so clinging is, you know, if we take it very lightly as being kind of a sin, then the clinging hurts. And so we're punished by the clinging in doing it. So it's, we can see that in many of the impulses that people do, that we consider to be unethical. Often, if you analyze or look carefully, you see there's some quality within that that probably the person is hurting or suffering behind that impulse. And so there's kind of instant karma, and the very acting in an angry way or in a greedy way or a hateful way, the greed and the hate itself is painful. Sometimes people are blinded by the object of desire, the object of hate, so they don't see the consequence, the effect greed or hate has on them. But if you are mindful and sensitive, you'll see that to be caught up in greed, caught up in hate, is painful for the person who's caught up. So there's an instant karma. So in that sense, you know, we're punished by what's going on. But karma is not just about punishment, if we use that kind of word. I don't like, it's not really a Buddhist word, but we're also receive the beneficial consequences of our impulses or actions as well. And so if we speak with kindness, and the impulse is out of kindness, then that also has a beneficial good feeling in the present moment. We're softer, we're lighter, we're maybe a little happier. And so there's instant karma that goes on with that as well. If you're generous in a genuine way, hopefully that generosity has a nice feeling to it as you do it. And so this instant karma feeling good. But karma is not just about how you feel in the moment. That's a very important guide for all this. Teaching of karma also is very much about that our actions, our behavior, has consequences. And that's kind of the bottom line for teaching of karma. The actions we'd have through body, speech, and mind, they have consequences. And when we're asked to have faith in karma, we're asked to have faith or trust or have confidence that our actions can make a difference, that we can choose actions that have beneficial consequences. We can differentiate between those actions which are helpful for us and those which are not. We can choose those consequences that are health producing and those which are not. And it's a kind of commonsensical thing. It's not like a difficult metaphysical principle that's being asked. We use it all the time in our daily life, this principle. You're not going to learn a new skill. You're not going to learn a musical instrument or a new accounting program or you're not going to learn how to learn a new recipe, cooking some food, unless you have some confidence in your ability that your actions will have consequences, beneficial consequences, that by repeated practice you'll learn that skill. You'll change and develop. And if you have no confidence at all that your actions have consequences, then perhaps you just wouldn't bother with doing anything to make any difference. And so when you learn like an instrument, musical instrument, it's not just simply the joy of the moment that we do it, but some people do it also with anticipation for the proficiency that's going to come into the future. And so we keep practicing. Sometimes it's quite boring to practice. But we have some sense we're learning a skill, it's beneficial, and the benefit's going to come in some time in the future. So same thing with karma. It's not just about the instant karma, the instant consequences, but it's also about taking into account that there are consequences into the future that we have. And so how do we lay the groundwork for behavior, for actions of speech and of mind that create beneficial consequences or a good foundation for what we want to accomplish? And so if what we want to accomplish in Buddhist practice is to become freer, more liberated, or more loving, more compassionate, or more peaceful, what are the conditions that support that? And so we look then at our life here and now. What supports that possibility? What supports us becomes more likely in the future? I'm pretty stressed out right now, so I know what I'm doing now is not working so well. So what is going to work? What will work in the future? So one possibility is some people are going to have to learn that they have to stop being so busy or so involved in activities that brings them a lot of stress. Stress is not doesn't bring the consequences of peace or well-being. So there has to be some changes in our behavior and what we do. Certain behavior like, gossip creates conditions which are very different than talking kindly about people or not talking about people behind their back. So Buddhists tend to look at their speech patterns, because not just because it has to do with ethics here and now, but it also it's laying the seeds, the foundation for our mind, our behavior, our happiness into the future. So in that sense, one of the meanings of karma, one of the concerns of karma, is how we're being conditioned. And as we know, I think the human mind is a conditionable organ. So the mind is not a thing, like the brain, which is kind of like a thing. The mind is quite malleable. It's an activity. The mind is a series of activities that work together, processes. And those processes of the mind can be shaped, and they are conditioned. And so whatever we do in a repeated way conditions it in particular ways. And so if a person's always being angry, always speaking bitterly about people, it conditions a certain kind of bitterness in the mind, which you're more likely to act on that in the future. If we act out of greed, that conditions it. And so we're more likely to act out of greed in the future. I've known people who just had greed without knowing what they wanted. just had a principle they should want. And then they'll find something to fill the blank. I want, it's just so powerful. It doesn't really matter, just finding something. The conditioning is there so strongly. So there's part of this conditioning. Some of the consequences of our actions have to do with memory. And memory gets stored. Who knows where it gets stored, but stored some deep inside our psyche or body or mind, and it comes back sometimes either to benefit us or to bite us. And I've had sat in meditation and then suddenly, seemingly out of the blue, said, oh no, what did I do? And it hadn't occurred to me, or somehow I thought I had gotten away with it. No one had noticed. But the inner psyche had noticed, and so And so there's a magic way, or this kind of special way in which the, as meditation practice deepens, it uncovers the layers of memory, layers of where we hold things, and they bubble up if things need to be bubbled up for our benefit or for our harm, depending on what's stored there. My teacher in Burma, he loved, for whatever reason, liked to tell us stories of some of the soldiers, Burmese soldiers or Burmese guerrilla fighters fighting the government. They would spend years, you know, in the jungle fighting each other, and then they would retire, and then they'd go become monks and come to the monastery to meditate. And he liked telling the stories of what their meditation was like. And he would talk about these people who they tortured, you know, other people, they killed other people. And he would talk about how tremendous barrier they were up against. They had to come to a certain point in their meditation practice, and they couldn't go any further because of these memories, these concerns, kind of the consequences that they were stored in their body of this. Kind of the same way that some people store trauma in their body. And so at some point that trauma, you know, might not be noticeable in daily life, but then if you get quiet and still, sometimes those layers of the psyche show themselves. But there are also good memories that bubble up. And it's not uncommon for some people when they meditate, especially newer meditators, is to remember pleasant memories or pleasant feelings from much earlier in life that they've lost touch with or forgotten. And for me, when I started meditating on a regular basis, I remembered feelings of well-being that I had as a child, going to bed, sleep at night, or, you know, a variety of different places that I had forgotten about for at that point, you know, for 15 years or so. And they came back, these wonderful memories, and they kind of were there to kind of buoy me up and kind of help me and support me as I meditated. And that was unexpected. Or my friend James Berez, I like his story he tells often about receiving. He was on a 3-month retreat, and he, you know, it's a kind of a little bit Spartan kind of diet. He does not have a lot of ice cream and cake and stuff. And a Vipassana retreat. And so, halfway at some point through the retreat, someone gave him a gift of a slice of cheesecake. I think he loves cheesecake. So there it was, you know, James was, you know, just for him. And no one else got cheesecake. And so somehow, you know, I don't know how it happened, but, and so he, you know, he was pretty excited. He loved cheesecake. And imagine all the pleasure of eating the cheesecake. And looking forward to this, you know, after being deprived of cheesecake for 2 months. And then I guess he thought about it for a while, and what he did instead of eating it was he cut it into really small little slices and put each slice on a little plate, I guess, and then put them out for other people to have. Maybe he had one slice for himself, I don't know, but he put them all out. And then he sat in the dining room in the corner and watched people came and they took their little slice. You know, I don't know how many people could take every slices he had, but took it. And he just felt so happy that he could do that. The point I'm telling you here is that James says that the happiness he felt from offering those slices of cheesecake, that lingered for decades. And I'm telling you the story now. Whereas if he'd had the cheesecake by himself and just had the pleasure in the moment, he probably wouldn't have remembered hardly. It wouldn't have had the same. So he was laying, you know, that act of generosity was laying the foundation of a good memory that continues to this day in some ways to bring happiness or a different kind of feeling than just, oh, the pleasure of it all. So our actions have consequences. And so part of Buddhist practice is to look at that and to know a little bit about how we act is going to have consequences, but also how we did act has consequences today. And so what happens to us today is partly the result of past choices we made. And so part of Buddhist practice is to be mature and responsible for the consequences we're living with. So to bear, you know, or be wise or patient or accepting of, you know, of the consequences that we have created through our actions. And I want to give you a very kind of subtle example, maybe subtle example of this. It wouldn't occur to someone unless they were kind of sensitive to these teachings of karma. Many years ago, I was driving to Monday night, to give a Dharma talk on a Monday night. And for whatever reason, I was driving a little bit faster than I usually do. I wasn't driving, you know, particularly fast, but more than I would normally do. So I was kind of pushing the gas pedal a little bit. I was a little bit impatient or in a hurry to get there to teach about being present. And I came off 280 on, this is back in Palo Alto. I came off 280, the freeway there, on Page Mill. And you come off there and there's a stop sign. There's a four-way stop sign there. And so I stopped. And there was a car coming from my left, but he had a stop sign too. So I stopped, and he was kind of far away. So I stopped, and I was going to keep going. You know, it was my turn to go. And I figured he would stop. But I guess he didn't see the stop sign. So he just kept going. And we missed each other by a centimeter. I mean, as far as I could tell, it was just like a miracle if we didn't hit each other. He just went right in front of me. Now, if he had hit me, legally, he was responsible, right? He ran the red, the stop sign. And it would have been quite normal to say, well, look, what were you doing? You just ran the light and bumped into me. From a karmic analysis, the responsibility of, you know, legal responsibility stays with him, and the bulk of the, you know, blame, I guess, stays with that person. But the karmic analysis is, I would look and say, what was my karma that caused it? And the karma, I would say that my karma, the part that I contributed to that accident would have been that I was going a little bit faster than I normally do. I was pushing. I had a little kind of greed or desire or impatience that I was acting on. Because if I hadn't been acting on that, I would have been 10 feet further back or 20 feet further back or whatever. I wouldn't have been there at that particular moment. As it was, my karma was just a centimeter right to avoid that accident. But I reflected afterwards about how if it had been an accident that I couldn't have left myself off the hook. And what was instructive to me was how easy it would have been to have assigned blame to that guy and never looked at myself, because it was so obvious that person was responsible, that no good, lousy driver. And because I was angry, I would have assigned everything on that person. But because I didn't have the accident, I took the time to look at myself and say, oh, you know, if we had an accident, and if I was really honest, there was some contribution for me. And the contribution for me has to do with karma. The contribution from him is his karma, his choices, whatever. But my contribution, based on how I've chosen to live, what I've chosen, the impulses I've chosen to act on, that's my karma. And those choices have consequences. Sometimes they have consequences in the physical world. Bang! And sometimes they don't. And sometimes the physical things in the world have nothing to do with my karma. I mean, it's possible I could have been driving really slow and, you know, really leisurely, really present and wise in my driving. But for whatever reason, that day, that big, slow semi hadn't been there on the freeway. And so I wasn't delayed by 30 yards. And I would have been where I was, where I had the accident at that time. And it wouldn't have been my karma because I was driving really carefully and well. But I had that accident. But because that truck slowed, you know, you understand what I'm trying to say? So it's very complicated, the cause and effect in the world. I like to say that karma tends, our karmic behavior tends to certain kind of results in the physical world. But we don't know, there's no guarantee what happens out there. And we want to be careful not to assign everything that happens to us as a result of our karma. However, the Buddhist teachings on karma is that there's an inevitable consequence with our karmic behavior. But it's not always in the physical world. And part of that, it might be in our inner world. You know, so some people, I've heard of some people I develop frozen shoulders from how they work in the computer for days and years at a time. And because it has to do with their behavior, how they held themselves and how they engaged in their work. And the Buddhist analysis is that their actions and their repeated actions help create that frozen shoulder. So that's kind of an inner thing for oneself rather than out in the world. Or it might be that we're creating a habit, a strong habit. Or, like I said earlier, conditioning. Or we create memory that's stored up that somehow comes back and bites us. Who knows how it comes back? And the Buddha said, you can't figure out all the avenues in which this kind of network of cause and effect works. But there is a feeling in Buddhism that one way or the other, your karma will come back and either support you or hinder you, depending on what kind of karma you make for yourself. So another way of saying this is that whatever you act on, whether it's physically, verbally, or mentally, you create more of the same. You create more of the same as the source of your action. So whatever the impulse, or the motivation, or the intention, there was a source for that action. That source, you get more of that if you act on it. So if you act on greed, if you act on hate, if that's the motivation, then you create more of something more in the same line or character as that. So you create more suffering because that has suffering as its source. If you act on things which have happiness or well-being or generosity or wisdom at its source of the impulse intention, you create more of that. You reinforce more of that. So somehow that comes back. Now, some of this is quite challenging because some people find that it can be very easy to act on unethical impulses, on act on greed, hate, and delusion. There's some very strong desires of greed, of whatever kind, and it's ready to occur. The trigger is set, and we're just ready to eat or get or buy or do whatever. Just it's so easy, and we feel frustrated or angry that anybody should stand in our way. And it's so easy to act sometimes on hate, on anger, on greed, on fear. And to not do that, to restrain ourselves, that's the real challenge. And sometimes for some people, like there are people have addiction problems or all kinds of things, anger problems, it takes a lot of resolve, a lot of mindfulness, sometimes a lot of inner strength to restrain from acting in ways which are going to cause bad karma, bad results. And sometimes to act in this, you know, in beneficial ways, to be generous, to be loving, to be kind, sometimes is not easily available for people. And sometimes it takes a lot of effort and work to kind of take the initiative to be generous and go that extra step. And you can feel like, well, this is a lot of work. So in the moment, for some people, people are untrained, it can be a lot easier sometimes to act on the unhealthy impulses, really easy, and it can be really difficult to act on the healthy impulses. So if to the degree where that's the case for some people, what we're trying to do in Buddhist practice is to reverse that, is to change that so that it becomes difficult to act on the unhealthy impulses and easy to act on the healthy ones. And so part of Buddhist inner development is to make that shift within. And so there's a variety of things that it takes to make that shift. One is restraint is a very important aspect of Buddhist practice, to restrain oneself from acting in those impulses which don't seem very healthy. And sometimes restraining oneself when the impulses are strong, when the addictions are strong or the anger is strong, is harder than riding a bronco in the rodeo. You know, they can be so powerful, and all the lawyers of the mind come up and to argue the fact that, you know, you're justified, or you should, or you need to yell, be angry, or punch that guy out. So, so it takes a lot of effort sometimes to act with restraint, but hopefully with time, and wisdom and understanding, those impulses become weaker and we're less likely to act on them. And eventually they begin to atrophy. And so it might bubble up an angry thought, but the thought is not tied to all the strong emotional impulse that's behind it. It's just, just a thought that comes up and we can let it go. And then it's replaced, hopefully, if practice is good, with almost a natural tendency to be open-hearted, to be generous, to be kind. And some of this can be understood almost mechanistically, I think, the results of being relaxed. The contrast between being stressed or tense versus being relaxed. When we're tense, it's a lot. There's a kind of a certain kind of charge or behind certain impulses that are easy to act on. That when you're relaxed, it's hard to act on those. When you're relaxed, there's a whole other set of things which are easy to act on. So when you're tense, it might be really easy to say something unkind, even to a good friend, because you're impatient, you're kind of tense and whatever. But if you're really relaxed, chances are you're not going to say the unkind thing because you're not going to have things spilling out of your mouth kind of in an unmindful way from that kind of place. So part of practice is learning restraint. And restraint, the word restraint, I think, to some people, is an oppressive word because it's oppressive. you're oppressing, you're holding back certain kind of impulse. But I would suggest that it can be done in a very healthy way when you understand how it's beneficial for you and how it's beneficial for others as well to hold back at times. And one of the places of restraint, of holding back, has to do with is taking the consequences of our past actions. So when we've acted in certain ways in the past that have certain results, maybe that are harmful, then be willing to take those results and have a certain degree of forbearance around it, restraint. So for example, I've had people angry with me. Sometimes I don't think they were justified, but sometimes they did. And sometimes their response was off the scale of appropriateness. Remember once I was teaching a retreat, and I set up a special interview with someone outside the regular interview schedule. And I know it was like for 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And I was going to give the Dharma talk that evening, so I was in my cabin preparing my talk. And at 4 o'clock, I said, "Oh no, I missed my appointment. I missed the interview with that person." So it wasn't like she had anywhere else to go or anything else to do, but still, I missed it, right? So I went and found her, and she was livid. And so I thought, well, this is partly my karma, partly my consequence, but also, she's creating a lot of karma here for herself. So what I did was, we met then for the next hour, and I sat there like I'm sitting here with her in a room, and she proceeded to be angry, yell at me for an hour. And I got really curious. Small degree, I felt like it was my responsibility to be present. It was, I'd blown it. The consequence of my blowing it was admitting it. I'm sorry, I did this. And take the consequences within reason. But I was also the teacher, so there was a whole different dynamic there of what was appropriate for me to do in response. And I felt the appropriate thing for me to do was just sit there and be curious. How long can a person have a monologue without anything coming from me? There's certainly something going on deep in her psyche that needed to be addressed, but she yelled at me for an hour. And you might think the appropriate thing to do was to stop her or protect myself. But I had the ability from my practice of healthy forbearance, healthy just sitting there. I wasn't forbearing, I wasn't restraining, I was just kind of empty. Just okay. It kind of like went right through. So that ability to kind of stay zero is a very powerful one in relationship to karma and consequences and ability to kind of just be there with things and not to act and react what's going on. The next day, and then at 5 o'clock the bell rang for tea. And then I said, oh, the bell, time to go. So I had an excuse to leave. And the next day she said, "Gil, that was so helpful." In the past, everyone is so afraid of my anger, they run away. And you stayed present. And so I don't know how big a consequence, how big change it made for her, but for her that was really helpful for her, that somehow she could be with herself in a certain kind of way, because I could be with it as well, rather than run away or attack in return or something. So to take the consequences and be willing to do that, and not run away, not be embarrassed, and just be there for it is an important part of this as well. And who knows what the consequences will be? Sometimes the consequences are stored in your body, in tension, in your, and so people, when they, sometimes when they come to meditate, they have to be able to stay, that take that consequence that's stored there, the tension that's held there, and so part of it is to learn how to be present for all that and not react, not run away, just let it work through you. And sometimes it's in your mind, where the consequences are. Sometimes it's in the world out there, because you set into motion certain cause and effect in the world. And who knows what direction, how it's going to go. So the Buddhist teaching on karma is meant to be an alternative understanding of what brings us alternative from the existing Indian ideas of the time of what are the causes for happiness and suffering, freedom and bondage. And at the Indian time of the Buddha, there were some people who believed that all your happiness and suffering was dependent on the gods. So you have to appease the gods, make sacrifice to the gods. It's just up to the gods. So that's where it came from. There are others who believed that it was all predetermined. Somehow or other, it's predetermined. A variety of predetermined understandings of your happiness. Nothing you could do. One predetermined idea was that it was all based on your past karma, completely on your past karma. Whatever happiness you have today, or what you're going to have, or any suffering, is completely preset by how you behaved in the past. The third one was theory was that your happiness and suffering is just random. You know, life just throws a dice. You wake up in the morning and the dice has been thrown. Who knows how what you're going to feel, but it's just kind of accident, you know, how you feel. Nothing you can do about it. Just throw the dice the next day. So those are kind of some existing ideas. And the Buddhist ideas counters each of those, meant an alternative. It's not about the gods. It's about you, your own mind, taking responsibility. Everything you need to do for creating liberation and happiness is found in your own mind, not somewhere else. You don't assign it somewhere else. And some people assign it not to gods, but to their spouse or their whatever. You know, elsewhere. It's up to them. They're going to do it for me. They're responsible. And the Buddhist thing to do is not to assign the responsibility of our happiness or our suffering to anybody but ourselves. There might be real world things to take care of, things to deal with that are difficult to deal with people. Not to deny that people are, you know, miss their stop signs, to assign our happiness and unhappiness to others is to miss an really golden opportunity, which Buddhism is pointing to. And then to the idea that it's all predetermined, the Buddha said that's not good, that's not true, because if it's all predetermined, you would have no chance to a spiritual life. There'd be no practice. And part of the function of practice is to free you from having to suffer from the pre-existing cause and effect, karmic conditions that have been set in motion. So it's a mechanical thing that has to always unfold in a certain way. But we can change the flow. We can step outside of the flow of the karma to some degree by how we you know, how liberated we are, how we change that stream. There's this famous karma story in the Buddhist tradition from Angulimala. And the short story is that he was a murderer at the time of the Buddha, who became a monk and then became enlightened. And after he was enlightened, he went back to a village where he had murdered someone for alms. And people recognized him, and they understandably threw stones at him And he came back to the Buddha all bruised up and cut and bloody. And he said, these people, beat me up. And he said, yes, that's your karma. That's the consequences. And your job is just to bear it. You have to bear it. You have to deal with that. You have to kind of be before it. However, because you practiced, he said this way, I guess said this way, if you hadn't practiced and attained some degree of liberation, changed that stream, you would have been reborn for many, many, many lifetimes in Buddhist hell. There's very bad consequences from killing people. So there are Buddhist hells, in case you wondered. So that, whether they're metaphorical hells, hells of our own mind, or hells, who knows. But in any case. All he had to do was suffer being beat up a little bit. So that was, that's a pretty good, he cleaned it up pretty well. So the idea of bearing it, being with what is there, taking the consequences, is a part of a mature human life. The Buddhist theory of karma, as I understand it, is not a theory of justice, even though it lends itself to that. Some people are really attached and want a world of justice. They want to know that person is going to get her just desserts. It's really important to know that person is not getting away with the terrible behavior they did. And and when they hear karma theory, they say, oh yes, oh thank God, yes, at least in the next lifetime. It's a relief. I don't think that's the purpose of karma theory in Buddhism, karma idea, is to have a theory of justice, regardless of how satisfying it might feel. My understanding is the central purpose of the karma theory is to help us do two things, two primary or three things. One is to encourages us to be in the present moment. It's a very, that's like one of the main purposes of all this complicated karma thing is stay present to what's happening here and now. Stay present enough so that you can notice what your intentions are, the quality of your intentions, because the quality of the intentions which sets in motion the karma wheel. And from the vantage point of the present moment, don't just stay in the present moment. Also, anticipate a little bit what the consequences are going to be in the future. So we're not just kind of blindly, naively just staying present, present, present. But we also have some sense of the potential that we can grow into. And then from that, some sense of that, then how can I behave now so I can grow into that potential, so I can support that? And at the very heart of what supports us is looking at our intentions. And are intentions based on greed, hate, and delusion? Or are they based on generosity, love, or wisdom? So part of people are interested in looking at their life, their point of view of karma. What they're doing is not assigning blame, not looking for justice in the world. They're looking in themselves and trying to understand the quality of this thing which is really close to the essence of our hearts. The quality, the characteristic of the impulses, the motivations, the volitions, the intentions upon which we build all our actions and activity in this world. What are those intentions like? What are the qualities like? What are the characteristics like? To look at that, to measure it, to look at it, to evaluate it, and then to make choices to restrain or let go of those which cause harm and pick up and encourage those that are beneficial for ourselves and for others. So it's very important to have confidence or faith in the theory of karma, because without that, you won't feel that your actions make a difference. And your actions do make a difference.